Okay, today is March 4th, 2008. This is the first interview with Bill Cronin. We're here at his office in Science Hall. This interview is being done for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Program's General Oral History Collection. Bill, thank you for agreeing to these interviews. If you would, to be able to check the sound level on your mic, could we get you to say your name and then spell your last name?
Sure. My name is William, middle initial J, Cronon, or Cronin is the way we pronounce it, but the spelling is C-R-O-N-O-N.
All right. And just before we turn this on, you asked how much of your ancestry we should get on here, and I just thought I'd just throw out sort of a general question about your ancestry, particularly as it pertains here to the Midwest and the work that you are now doing.
Sure. I'll talk more about my childhood and growing up. I was actually born in New Haven, Connecticut, but on both my parents' sides, my roots go deep back into Wisconsin and Minnesota and the upper Mississippi Valley, upper Midwest. Really, I think all my ancestors were immigrants to Wisconsin or Minnesota in the middle of the 19th century or second half of the 19th century. My name is Irish, but I'm only actually about 1/8 Irish. Most of my other ancestors are German. So my four grandparent names are Cronin, Fox, Meyer, and Hotmar. My parents, who met at the University of Wisconsin when my father was a graduate student in the history department here and my mother was in the nursing school, my father was the son of an architect who worked for the federal government in the Minneapolis area. My dad was born in Minneapolis and grew up there. His ancestors, I think his earliest Irish ancestors that came to Wisconsin arrived here in the first half of the 19th century and homesteaded or farmed in the area around La Crosse in the Coulee country. I believe my father's mother's father was a butcher in the La Crosse area. In fact, I have butchers on both sides of my ancestry. My mother's mother's father was a butcher in the Waterloo area. So on both sides, it's kind of German small shopkeeper, I guess, is what that ancestry was about. As I said, my father's father was an architect working for the FHA in Minneapolis. My mother's father and mother started a small hardware store in Princeton, Wisconsin, which is located about 70 miles north of Madison in the Fox River Valley. They started it in 1928, I believe, in Princeton, not what you would think would be an auspicious year for starting a small business in a central Wisconsin town, but in fact, they flourished and made it through the Depression, though the Depression made a powerful stamp on both of my parents, I would say. And I knew all my grandparents growing up. None of them, they all lived to a fairly advanced age. My mother's father died earliest, a lifetime smoker of lung cancer in his late 60s. But the reason why I knew those grandparents as well as I did, and this ties to my interests in the Midwest and why I now do the work I do, is that in this small town of Princeton where my grandparents ran the hardware store and my mother was born in a house behind the hardware store, my grandparents built one of the first small cottages at the west end of Green Lake, which is about 7 miles from Princeton. My mother spent all of her summers growing up on Green Lake, and then after she married and had children, Green Lake became, and that cottage became, a kind of central part of my brothers and my childhood and the childhood of my cousins, my mother's sister's children as well. So we spent virtually all of our summers growing up on Green Lake, even when we were living elsewhere in Connecticut or in Nebraska. So the summertime pilgrimages to Green Lake were really my first encounter with the Middle West and with the Wisconsin landscape, and made a really very deep impression on me. I could talk more about my experience of Princeton and Green Lake growing up. You may or may not want to ask me questions about that. I guess I came away partly from that experience with a very strong impression of the hard work and commitment to community. My grandparents were immensely hard-working people. They really poured their lives into that hardware store as well as into the community. My grandmother served on the school board for many, many years in Princeton. And just sort of watching the roles they played in that town and how central they were to the life of that town, how many people knew them. My grandmother was really the the financial brains of the business. She did all the bookkeeping, did all the ordering, all the financial stuff was her duties, whereas my grandfather, my mother's father, was really the jack of all trades handyman, who if you needed plumbing done, if you needed electrical work done, if you needed an appliance installed or whatever, he was the guy who did that work. Mm-hmm. And they had a very complete partnership in that respect. So that's broad background. If you have other questions, I can tell you more.
I do. I want to come to something you mentioned about halfway through that, and that's your parents living through the Depression and how that shaped them. Sort of reflecting on it now, being able to look back on it, what are some of the ways that your parents making it through the Depression shaped how they dealt with life?
Well, I would say that they were both people who, as children growing up in the 30s, I don't think it would be fair to say they experienced the extremes of poverty, although I think my grandfather was unemployed for a period. I don't think they were never on the street. They were never at that level of poverty. But both of my parents were acutely conscious of the value of money and the risk of losing money, what true hardship could look like if you didn't have the safety net of some small means beneath you. So all of their lives, they were savers in the extreme. Although my father did very well in his career, certainly both they entered the professional classes, he earned a good income. I would say they never lived at their full level of income. They were always socking away money, saving money, investing money, and very, very mindful that not spending the money you had, not buying the most expensive things was a very, very important value in order to save against a rainy day, as it were. So being very mindful of the risks associated with economic downturns that you couldn't control, I would say, was a big part of both my parents' values and what how they handled money, how they thought about money. I'd also say that they were both people who did not think that money was the way you necessarily had to enjoy yourself. In other words, spending money for the sheer sake of enjoyment, as opposed to sitting around a table playing a board game or having a conversation or going for a walk or doing things that didn't involve large sums of money, tended to be what they defaulted to in their own recreational and family activities. So we grew up doing tons of stuff, but in general it was tons of stuff that was not expensive stuff, and that was, I think, one of the marks that the Depression left on both of my parents.
So how often and or how long would you spend in Princeton? And then, I'm sorry, was it Green Lake?
Green Lake is the name of the lake. There's a Green Lake Village at the other end of the lake from where we spent our summers. But I would say, I can't tell you, it wasn't the same every year, but I would say in general, we were at that cottage at Green Lake from my preschool years through high school, from probably June through August. So it was my father, because he was an academic, had summers where he could either be working at the cottage, or because when we eventually moved to Madison, he could drive back down to Madison, spend a work week there while my mother and the two boys were up at the cottage. So sometimes he would be commuting back and forth between Madison and Green Lake once we got back to Madison in 1962. Other times we would just be there for an extended period. There were years in which, as we moved toward teenagerhood, where we split the cottage between the two families who shared it, my mother's family and her sister's family. So in that period, we were there for only half the summer. But in general, my childhood memory is we spent the whole summer at Green Lake. There were exceptions where, in one very, very important year, a benchmark year in my life, when I was in fifth grade, my parents loaded my brother and I into the back of a green and white Ford station wagon, and we did a great circumnavigation of the western United States, west from the Black Hills to Yellowstone, and then basically to California, down the coast, to the southwest, to Grand Canyon, up through Colorado, back to Madison. And that was really my first sustained encounter with the western landscapes of the United States and the national parks, and absolutely that and subsequent family trips. My parents were very big on camping in a car trailer, and then eventually we got into backpacking as well. Those trips to Western locations where we camped and hiked are defining parts of my childhood, and I'm quite sure I would not now be doing what I do. I wouldn't be studying the history of Americans' relationships to the land, or the history of the national parks, or the history of conservation and environmentalism, if I hadn't had those family trips in my childhood. So those are another component of our summer times. But again, the anchor was that cottage at Green Lake.
Growing up in rural Idaho and not being very close to a lake at all, I picture, you know, spending a summer at the lake as, you know, fishing, swimming, tootling around the lake. Is that where your memories lie of your time at the lake, or is it broader than that?
That's a big part of it. Spending summers at the lake is a kind of canonical Wisconsin and Minnesota experience. In fact, it's almost a joke that Wisconsinites refer to the cottage on the lake. And it doesn't matter which family it is, and doesn't matter which lake it is, it's always the cottage or the cabin on the lake. Ours was the cottage. I was never much into fishing. I actually rather hated fishing because of the cleaning up of the dead animal and its smell that went with it. Though my family did wax and wane in its fishing activities. Certainly though, swimming in the lake, taking out water skiing behind a motorboat, or taking a canoe out for an extended period. My father, who loved sailing, had a M20 sailboat, an inland lake scow, and we spent many, many long hours sailing around the lake, which was quite wonderful. We had beach fires on the beach at least weekly, if not multiple times a week, roasting marshmallows or making s'mores, those kinds of nighttime activities. And when I mentioned board games, actually board games are a very, very important part of my childhood. My mother and her sister were Scrabble addicts in the extreme. So playing Scrabble, playing Monopoly, playing Michigan Rummy, playing Bridge and Hearts. In fact, we had a version of Hearts that my father modified, the classic game of Hearts, which we called Cronin Hearts. And I would say hundreds of hours went into playing Hearts and other games like that. So there were a lot of family game time activities and lots of walks along the shore or along the roads in that area, and tons of reading, actually. So a lot of what went on there was reading.
Okay. Do you recall how you felt, and it might be a general impression, might be something you haven't thought of, how you felt when you knew you were going to take a trip to sort of navigate the U.S. West, you know, as a fifth grader? Is that something that had appealed to you? Something that, oh, geez, we're going on a trip, we're going to be gone from home for multiple months?
I don't really have a very good answer to that question. I don't have a strong memory of reacting to the idea of that trip. I think we had actually done car camping trips prior to that big trip. That big trip is in my mind as a defining one because it covered so much of the West. But even when we lived in Lincoln, Nebraska for a couple of years, when I would have been in first grade and second grade, first and second grade, we had a camper trailer that you could pull behind the car. And we definitely, even in that period, were making trips to the western part of Nebraska or to the Rocky Mountain National Park near Boulder, Colorado. And so those were early trips into the West. And I, although I'm sure there were times when my brother and I were bored or would have been rather to be doing something else, I mainly remember those car camping trips as some of the best times that our family spent together. And my father, who of course was an American historian like me, though focused in rather different areas than I am now focused, was unbelievably knowledgeable about the places through which we traveled, and was a great storyteller. And so one of my very strong memories of those trips is of my father telling the stories of the places that we were visiting. So we would follow the Oregon Trail west across Nebraska, and we would visit Scott's Bluff, and he would tell us the story of the Oregon Trail along that route. Or we would go to Rocky Mountain National Park or Yellowstone, and he would always have stories to tell about people or things or events that happened in those places. And again, it's what I now do, so it's one of the many gifts that my father gave me, was that habit of believing that things around us are more meaningful when we know the stories behind them of how they came to be the way we are, and in particular when we narrate those things, when we tell stories about those things. So I just remember lots and lots of stories from my father, lots of walks, lots of hikes, lots of campfires, cooking meals together. And I don't remember actually a lot of friction between my brother and me with each other, or between us and our parents during that early period of say through pre-adolescence, through that period. It was just, they were great family times.
So I was gonna ask about how you felt when you found out you were going to move to Madison from Nebraska, but it sounds like you had spent enough time in Wisconsin that...
I should probably tell the journey of how we went where and how we happened to wind up where we did. I was born in New Haven, Connecticut. My parents were married, I believe, in 1950, if I'm remembering the date right, and I was born in 1954 on September 11th, a date that has now become infamous. And my father had finished his PhD at Wisconsin, I think probably around 1952, though I don't have that date in my head. And his first job, which came late in the job market, for a while he could have had a completely different career than the one he did, because he had an offer from a very different institution, but sort of late in the process of deciding where he would go, he got suddenly an offer from Yale University to join the faculty there as an assistant professor, which at Yale in those days was essentially a revolving door, meaning if you began as an assistant professor at Yale, unless you were a very unusual person, it was almost a guaranteed certainty that you would not get tenure at Yale. So it would be a finite amount of time, and then you would move on to somewhere else. Though Yale is a great place to leave, and that was one of the ways that Yale essentially justified not having a tenure track for its junior faculty. So we moved, my parents moved to New Haven, I think around 1952 or thereabouts, at about the same time that my father got his PhD. My mother was a registered nurse by training, had worked in a hospital in the 1940s, and actually for a while taught nursing at the Yale Nursing School in the early 1950s. She had a master in nursing. And my father joined the history department at Yale, where he remained until I think about 1959, 1960, teaching the United States Survey course. Interestingly, one of his close colleagues at Yale would eventually be my mentor at Yale, a man named Howard Lamar, who's one of the great historians of the American West of the second half of the 20th century. Howard had gotten to Yale, I think, a little before my father, though they were essentially contemporaries and very close. They co-taught that course together, the U.S. history course. My father was a political U.S. historian of the 20th century. His work was on the Progressive Era and essentially the period from, say, the 1890s or the 1900s to the 1930s or thereabouts. And so he was at Yale for, I guess, six, seven years, something like that. I do not have strong memories, so I would have been at Yale from ages 0 through ages 5. I do not have many memories of Yale from that period. I have a few that are vivid, fragmentary memories, which are actually indicative of important family contacts with New Haven and with Yale. We lived on the west side of New Haven at a little place called Westville, below West Rock, the two great massifs that stand on either side of New Haven, Connecticut, the Trap Rock Ridges that define so much of interior Connecticut and down in New Haven, and our house was immediately below one of those Trap Rock Ridges in Westville. And one great, great family tradition, which is still part of my family's tradition, is that New Haven is famous for pizza. The legend is that New Haven introduced pizza to the United States in the 1930s, and there actually are, I think, still three, maybe four restaurants in New Haven that still have the coal-fired ovens that were built in the 1930s that serve this early pizza. And it's a very thin-crusted pizza, unlike anything you can get in Madison. Very fresh ingredients, wonderful, wonderful pizza. And every Sunday, actually, there was a pizza place about two blocks from where my parents lived. My dad and I would walk down to the pizza place, get a Italian pizza in a box and carry it back to our house and have that pizza. And I vividly remember that pizza and that pizza parlor. And the New Haven in my mind will always be a mecca for pizza. Whenever I go there now, I never don't have New Haven pizza. In fact, I've been known to buy extra New Haven pizzas, freeze them, and carry them back in the plane to bring to family members back here in Madison. I remember one wood paneled room from that period in my life, which must have been a Yale office or a Yale classroom. I remember West Rock, the rock behind our family's house, and that's just about it. That's about all I think I remember from those first 5 years. And then quickly to take you to what brings us back to Madison for the period of my childhood that's most relevant to the questions you're probably wanting to ask about. I think in about 1959, 1960, my father had a sabbatical year to work on a book involving research in the Library of Congress. So we moved to Washington, D.C. By then, my father's parents were living in Tacoma Park outside of D.C. And we lived in their house. They were away for some reason that I don't remember. So we lived in their house. I went to school, my first year of school, in Washington, D.C. And my main memory of that period, which is actually also relevant to subsequent interests, was, of course, this is the height of the Cold War. It's the height of the period of nuclear testing and of tensions between the United States and Russia over nuclear weapons. And I, for whatever reason, probably because I was in the duck and cover generation, the kids would have tests literally every week where you would have to get under your desks in the classroom and put your hands over your head and kneel on the floor in anticipation of a nuclear attack. And I have ever since had vivid images of nuclear warfare that are a defining part of my childhood memories. And one recurring dream, actually, that I have had multiple times over the course of my life. Not, I haven't had it for years, but it's essentially a dream where the sirens go off, you know that the nuclear missiles are headed in your direction, in the dream, I'm trying to persuade my parents. It's a Madison dream, actually, so it's from a slightly later period, though its roots date to this year in D.C. I'm trying to persuade my parents that they need to go down in the basement. We need to put a makeshift fallout shelter together. Nobody pays attention. They're not interested, so I race to the basement. The bomb goes off, and I'm left alone in this post-nuclear world. It's a very vivid, very painful dream. And what I remember, oddly, from that year in D.C., in addition to all the time to be down on the mall, visiting the Smithsonian, going to the Washington Monument, touring Congress, all the canonical tourist activities that everybody does in D.C., it was the first time I'd ever lived in a major metropolitan area where there were sirens every night many times. Fire sirens, police sirens. That was just not part of what I remembered growing up. And because those sirens were now framed in this nuclear context of the Cold War, every time one of those sirens went off, I thought it was the war. I thought it was the missiles were flying. And it was a very oddly anxious year living there. And again, it left a permanent mark on me that remains a part of my childhood, as I think it is for a number of the kids who were baby boomers in that period of the heightened civil defense and very high public consciousness of the nuclear threat to the United States and presumably in the other direction to the Soviet Union. And we may talk more about that. That actually is a more important part and a defining part of my environmental consciousness and concerns than it might appear to be on the surface. It's not a trivial story I just told you. We were in D.C. for that year, and then my dad got an offer of a tenured position, associate professor at the University of Nebraska. So he moved there, I think we moved there in 1960 or thereabouts, and we would then be there for a couple of years living in Lincoln on Broadmoor Drive, which I actually recently revisited when I spoke in Lincoln last fall. And I don't have a lot of strong memories of Lincoln, and you may or may not have an interest in those. I remember very tall snowdrifts that were taller than a human being because I was very short in those days. So relative to me, the snow felt very big. That was the period, as I've already said, when we began our camping trips to the West, which would become such an important part of our family tradition, culture, and my worldview. But unless you've got questions about that, to close that part of the story, we moved finally to Madison, which I think my father was delighted to get an offer from the University of Wisconsin, as it was then called. So we moved back there in 1962. My parents bought a house on the west side of Madison, what was then the far edge of Madison at 5601 Varsity Hill, the house that they only just a year and three quarters ago, moved out of. So from 1962 until 2006, My parents lived in that house where my brother and I grew up. Me from third grade was the first year that I spent in the Madison Public Schools, my brother from first grade. And that house, which was then located at the far edge of development in Madison with a great cornfield laid out behind it as its backyard, one of the defining parts of my childhood was watching that great field undergo the very complicated set of transitions involving agricultural abandonment and then subsequent infill, subdivision, building of houses, and the filling in of the west side of Madison by suburbanization is something essentially my childhood witnessed. Without my being able to describe it in the way I just did, I wouldn't have labeled it in that way. And yet watching the transformation of that landscape was a big part of my childhood. And again, I think a part of my consciousness as I grew older, a fascination for change in landscape and the interactions between environmental change and human land use, human values, human ideas, which have become so central to what I as an intellectual now focus on. I do think that that experience of growing up on the far west side of Madison and watching that particular phase of American suburbanization fed into that. I have a colleague at Penn State named Adam Rome, who wrote a wonderful book called The Bulldozer in the Countryside, which is a history of post-World War II suburbanization, and he actually makes the argument that environmentalism, as it emerges in the 1950s and 60s, is in part a response of people living on the suburban fringe to watching the transformation of the environment around them. And certainly my own life experience would support that thesis, that people growing up and living in that constantly changing landscape, constantly changing environment, part of which is landscapes of early childhood that are beloved places of childhood play that are then chewed up and absorbed by the suburbanizing process. There's something about the suburbs being a landscape of loss, in which things that looked like they were permanent and stable are then consumed by subsequent development, is one of the attributes that feeds into environmental politics as it emerges in the 1960s. But that's just a very quick narrative. Mm-hmm. There are probably other things I could tell you about being an academic brat and living in universities. They'll probably come up before we're done, but you probably should ask me if you have any questions about the New Haven, Lincoln, sure. DC, Madison narrative.
And I sort of do, which ties into some general questions that I have written down. When did you, or can you, or do you know when you realized what your father did as a vocation?
I think I knew very early on what my father did as a vocation. I would say I knew he was a historian and a writer and a teacher. I would say by the time I was in kindergarten or first grade, and it was I'm quite sure that I knew that he wrote in part for a living, and writing turned out to be a defining part of my very early childhood. One of the things that my father had done when he was young, and I'm quite sure there's an Oedipal component to this, in which I was trying to, I don't know whether to say compete with my father on my own on his own ground. That certainly one could interpret certain parts of our father-son relationship in that way. But when he was a kid, growing up in Minneapolis, he had edited a little neighborhood newspaper that he had made for himself with an old hectograph back in the days, and the technology I'm not even sure exists anymore, where you would make a gelatin in a flat tray, and you can do it just with cooking gelatin. You make this firm gelatin on a flat surface, and then using a special purple pencil, which in my childhood was the same chemical that the old hectograph, the Ditto machines, that handouts were made in the public schools back in those days. You would write with this purple pencil on a sheet of paper, lay it down on the gelatin surface, and it's in a slightly damp condition, peel it back, and it would leave the purple ink on the gelatin surface, and then you put additional sheets of paper down on it, and it would be transferred about 10 or so, 10 or 15, onto the sheets that you laid on. And then he had done this as a kid, and had then sold these little neighborhood newspapers to the neighbors around his house. And I must have learned about that when I was in first or second grade. He still had those old newspapers. We still do, the ones he had done as a kid. And so I embarked on the project of being a newspaper editor, I would say in second or third grade. I think we first did these in maybe Lincoln. And I did actually neighborhood newspapers. The one I did was called the Varsity Variety by the time we moved to Madison. And I think I was still doing that as late as maybe fourth or fifth or sixth grade. And then when I got to high school, just to close out that little narrative strand, I actually edited an underground newspaper, this is the late 60s, of course, in James Madison Memorial High School on the west side of Madison, where I went to high school. For I think 3 of the years that I was in high school, I did a weekly, and it was a very reliable weekly newspaper done on a mimeograph machine, where I recruited writers from all around the high school to do articles. I wrote, I edited, and distributed this newspaper, actually in large quantities. I think we produced maybe 200 copies of this thing and distributed it all around the high school. And oddly, it was really my first sustained, this goes back to grade school. I was doing writing and editing, essentially acting like a junior journalist from a very early age. And if I go through the boxes of stuff that my parents preserved from my childhood, even stuff I'd long forgotten, it's very clear that by the time I was in third or fourth grade, I thought I was going to be a writer, and writing was a big part of my identity. If you'd asked me in junior high what I wanted to be, I would have told you probably that I wanted to be a novelist or that I wanted to write. And this all comes back to your question about my awareness of my father's vocation. I knew of him, I knew he was a writer. He was one of the best writers I knew. I learned more about writing from my father than any other single human being on this planet. He was a superb editor. And so everything I wrote, all those newspaper things, once they were in more than one draft, and the initial ones were not in more than one draft, every time I wrote a school paper, every time I wrote an essay or short story, I would take it to my father. And he would blue pencil the hell out of it. I mean, he would edit it within an inch of its life. As it's very hard to find anybody who will devote that kind of labor and energy to one's prose. And it disciplined me. It taught me things about writing and editing that I don't think ever have learned from anybody else. And he never stopped doing that, actually. Even late in his life, I would continue to give drafts of things I wrote to him. And he would continue to edit and make comments and suggest possible improvements in a way that I'll be forever grateful for it. And it's one of the things that has motivated me all through my life to do the same thing with my children and also to do the same thing with my students. Editing prose is the hardest work I know. It's a huge amount of labor. It's an enormous time commitment. Most teachers don't do it because they're just not willing to put in the time and energy, or they think it's someone else's job to do it. And in a funny kind of way, it's one of the ways I try to pay back my many debts to my father is to pass on that gift that he gave me of careful editing, careful attention to language and prose, and all those basic written communication skills. The one other answer to the question is that I absolutely knew my father was a historian. Maybe this was even in Lincoln. I think it actually started in Lincoln, so that would have put it back in the second grade for me. But certainly, when we were in Madison in third or fourth grade, I was a precocious kid. I was a voracious reader. I read and wrote above my grade level very early. And a consequence of that was that maybe because my dad had so inculcated scholarly, rigorous values into me from such an early age, I actually helped him proofread his book manuscripts. So as a second or third or fourth grader, the way you do the proofreading of a book is you have a set of galleys you've gotten from the typesetter, and you've got your original copy edited manuscript, and one person has to read to the other, word for word, paragraph per paragraph, comma by comma, dash by dash, period by period, quotation mark by quotation mark, every single character that's on the copy edited manuscript so that the other person can check against the galleys to make sure that the two correspond with each other. And weirdly, my father was trusting me. I'm still kind of amazed that he trusted me to do that when I was in second or third grade with him. But I can't tell you the lessons I learned from that. The gesture of respect from him, that he trusted me enough to do that. I think I was conscious even then that that was a big deal, that I was being asked to do a very grown-up, very scholarly thing as a very young child. But also, when you do that, if you make a mistake, it's consequential. And my father, of course, would catch the mistake. The beauty of doing it, the reason I think he could safely trust me, is if I got it wrong and I was the one reading out loud, he would hear an error that wasn't on his galleys. He would ask me, and I would thereby be corrected. So it was a kind of self-correcting process. But it was actually my first sustained encounter with scholarship and with the rigors of careful textual reproduction. Part of what the challenge of history is to gather these documents, which you then copy accurately and analyze and interpret deeply. And it turns out that actually copying a quotation is a very hard thing to do accurately. It's astonishing how hard it is to do it accurately. One of my father's favorite seminar assignments for his graduate students was to send them into the library and take any 10 pages out of any article or any book and check all the sources. And the amazing thing about that exercise is it was almost unheard of for the students not to come back finding errors out of a random 10 pages, which tells you that the world is rife with error, that there's error everywhere that most of us never notice because we never check it against the sources. So checking against the sources was one of the early lessons of that process. It's a very long answer to a short question.
I have a follow-up to this, and I don't mean any offense by it. As you're giving your father some of your work later on in life, are you doing that because he's still a valuable source to you in terms of editing and reading, or is it something you're doing as an homage to your father to continue to have a connection with him?
I don't experience any even potential offense in that question. I don't see why. It doesn't strike me as an either-or choice. I suspect it's both. Meaning, I'm certainly paying him a respect by sharing work with him and wanting his input. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't doing that purely as to flatter him. It was that because he continued to be a careful, rigorous reader and editor who found things and caught things that other people wouldn't find. It certainly was a valued, ongoing dialogue. There is another phase to my relationship to my father that was fraught with conflict during the Vietnam War. We had some very difficult times. And we went through a patch where there were periods when it almost felt like we couldn't speak with each other. It was just too volatile, too angry, too emotional. And so the second part of your question, I think there is a way in which moving out of that conflictual space, which we may get to before we're done here, the sharing of work, the talking about work, one of the many places that he and I met each other and built our adult relationship lay in the fact that we were both historians, both deeply committed to the study of the past, both writers, both committed to careful language. So much of my relationship to language is mediated by my relationship to my father, that all those became ongoing bases for the ongoing relationship between us. But the quick answer to the question, it's both and, not either or.
I just personally, being able to have someone who you trust to read your stuff, and to have that be a father, I think is got to be a win-win situation.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, we talked about your father, and I know we will come back to this now since you've mentioned the student unrest. That's something I want to get to at some point. But I'm interested in your mother, now that I know she has a nursing background. After you and your brother were born, did she stay at home during the period of your growing up? Did she work as well?
My mom was mainly at home during our growing up years. At least my memory is that she was mainly at home. I have a feeling that during very early infancy, she was still working some at the Yale New Haven Hospital, where my brother and I were both born, and curiously, both of my children were born in that same hospital because of this curious pendulum. My life has moved back and forth between New Haven and Madison. But I do not remember, as a young child, my mother mainly working. I think she had part-time nursing jobs that she would do, say, during the hours when we were at school. But I remember my mother sending us off to school in the morning and being there when we got home. And I remember that being one of those trusted features of a child's day that was not much interrupted by whatever work she may or may not have been doing for paid employment during those years. So I think the answer is I knew she was a nurse. Absolutely, there were times through my childhood when she was putting in some hours at a local doctor's clinic in Madison, say. And particularly when we were in school full time, she would do that part of the time. But it was her working is not a big part of my childhood memory of the family, I would say. The other things to know about my mother, I guess, that are relevant to me and how I came to be who I am and do what I do, are that my parents had a remarkable marriage. They were very, very different human beings in so many ways. But I've known few marriages where the differences between the two people were more complementary and more beloved by the other person. They both drew energy and stability from each other that neither one of them would have had in the absence of each other. So my father's death a year ago, December, is a really major, major rupture in a profoundly important relationship between the two of them. I mean, whereas he was serious and earnest and fascinated by questions of high principle and politics and the kinds of abstract ideas and concerns that academics care so much about, she is much more of the moment, much more social, vibrantly alive, kind of engaged with every human being around her. And I think my mother, if I had to guess, kind of opened my father's world up for him in part. She became one of the ways that he could put himself, a fairly shy, introverted person, which would describe me as well, out into a social world that she would help him navigate because she was just so comfortable and eagerly engaged with other human beings. The other thing, she was devoted to her children and poured endless time and energy into activities for us, of which I think I was a huge beneficiary growing up. I was an unusual kid. I think it was clear to my parents early on that I was really bright, and I don't say that to toot my own horn. I actually think my brightness was a challenge and a awkwardness of the. I remember, I think at a very early age, first or second grade, the school suggested to my parents that I should skip a grade. And they, I think, without involving me in it, I subsequently, much later, learned, had a long dialogue about it and really decided that they didn't want me to advance a grade beyond, even though intellectually I could have handled it, because of the emotional consequences of being chronologically out of sync with my peer group. And that is an important value, I would say, that is, I think both my parents were committed to it, but it's an expression of something I think that I importantly got from my mother, which is, although I think she loved all the stuff I did, she loved my activities and my projects and all these hobbies that we did, she fed them. So you know, we would do the kinds of hobbies that filled my childhood largely because my mother fed them and made them possible, butterfly collecting or fossil collecting or rock collecting, endless collections of natural history stuff of one kind or another, that my mother just put in endless hours making that possible, facilitating that. I think many of those were done at her prompting, but once she'd gotten them started, I just poured infinite energy into them and they became an important part of her and my relationship. But the value that she, that I'll be forever grateful to her for having given me, is that my mother thinks of herself as a very ordinary person. She thinks of herself as not being very smart, certainly not being an academic, and of course she's married to a very high-profile, high-achieving academic, and she's got a high-achieving son. And it was very, very important to my mother, and she said it many, 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 many times, that smart people weren't any better than anybody else, that everybody was as good as everybody else, and that you shouldn't get a big head, and you shouldn't have a big ego, and you shouldn't think that you're somehow superior. Your job is to use your talents and do things with your talents that are good for everybody, not because you want a spotlight on yourself, but because there's just good and important work to do in the world, and you should treat everybody with respect. Everybody matters. And that's a profoundly, deeply hardwired value in me, which is to say, there's a huge emotional loading on that one, probably because it echoes things, I'm sure, in my parents' marriage, it echoes things in my deep childhood, but I have an almost visceral drawing back from actions on my part that call attention to me in a way that would make me look better than people. And it's very conflicted because, of course, I like being recognized for doing good work. Who doesn't? I have an ego like everybody else does. I'm happy to be recognized. And yet, every time I get that reward, I'm instantly suspicious of that reward because I worry that it's feeding an ego thing that is unhealthy and is a bad value. And I'll never lose that, meaning I'm caught in the conflict of high achievement on the one hand, that's highly rewarded by my parents on the one hand, and don't think you're better than anybody else on the other. It's a very double-edged kind of message. And it's not a comfortable one. I don't occupy that space with great comfort. And yet, part of me thinks it's one of the most important things my parents gave me, because it makes me at least aspire to try to be a decent human being. And that strikes me as a worthy aspiration, might be a way I'd put it. And both my parents signaled that in different ways, but it was a particularly important value I think I got from my mom.
To maybe try to tie that into these camping trips you took. So reflecting on it, or maybe you know this, was it your mother then that drove, not the car, but drove the idea of going out?
No, quite the opposite. One of the things I've learned since my dad died, is that my mother has trouble making decisions. That's one of her qualities. I think that has become more amplified since she's gotten older, but I kind of think it was always there. And I'm absolutely clear, relative to your question, that it was my father, absolutely my father, who was the one who decided to do big things that involved projects, or not projects, but travel in particular. He was the decider when it came to travel. I think if it had been up to my mother, she would have spent every summer on Green Lake, and that's where we would have gone. It was my dad who wanted to put us in a car and drive us off to tour the West. And although my mother threw herself into that, loved it, it was as an important part of her young adulthood and family years as it was for my father. I'm very, very sure that had my father not grown up as an Eagle Scout, Boy Scout, attending camp in northern Minnesota, canoeing and hiking and doing all the things that an Eagle Scout does, that would not have been part of our childhood. So he drove the outdoor camping activities, even though she then embraced those and they became as important to her as they were to him.
You mentioned your early interest in collecting butterflies and rocks, I think were two of the things you mentioned. Reflecting on it, is that something you see as you being able to do something enjoyable, but also something that you said yourself, you're growing up sort of shy and introverted, and these are things you can do as an individual. These are sort of sedentary activities that don't necessarily involve interaction with humans unless you want it to.
It's possible that's true. I was certainly a kid, I would say, growing up, who had relatively few friends. I had usually one or two or three close friends. This is through junior high. Interestingly, usually girls. Most of my closest relationships through grade school were not with boys, but with girls, partly because I loathed athletics and organized sports. I really was no good at them, and that may be part of it. I kind of didn't want to be good at them. I wasn't good at them, and so I think I chose passive-aggressively to not engage and not compete in that masculine world of recreational sport activity. But absolutely, the activities I was drawn to, reading again most especially, I was a voracious reader. By the time I was in third grade, I had read all of the Lord of the Rings. By the time I was in junior high, I had read Lord of the Rings 9 times, once in a single sitting, which tells you something about, and actually the Lord of the Rings would be in my top 10 defining books of my life. I have a very important relationship. There are big chunks of my life that are explicable are inexplicable without reference to Tolkien and Lord of the Rings and Lewis and the Narnia books. But the question about whether collecting was an expression of my introversion, I think the broader answer is yes, I was drawn to solitary activities or activities with my mom or with close family members, like with my cousins at the cottage, or with these few friends that I had through grade school years. It was not until I was in eighth grade at James Madison Memorial High School on the West Side that I finally found a close friend. Michael Zarnstorff was his name. He's now a plasma physicist at Princeton University, who was as fascinated by the life of the mind and as drawn to kind of really intense intellectual engagements and as I was. And so I think it was not until eighth grade that I really felt like I had a peer in the deep sense of that word. And I don't, again, mean that in the ego sense of my equal. What I'm about to say is a really important part of me. I go through life assuming that most of what most interests me is boring to most people. So I rarely volunteer my own stuff to people around me because I just assume they're bored by it. And until I'm in a relationship where I know that the person is interested in what I have to say, I tend to be quiet about the stuff that's in my head because I assume it's just kind of burdensome and is boring or intimidating or a bunch of negative stuff, mm-hmm. which is only going to lose me friends if I share it. So I tend to be silent by default, and most especially I tend to be a listener, meaning I'm interested in almost anything. I'm interested in almost everyone. So I'm quite happy, actually, usually, just listening to find out what there is to find out about the people that I'm interacting with. And that comes back now to the question about collecting, where you started. I would say what's important about the collecting activities is not so much that they were escapes from the realm of the social. I think I did that by default, and my best symbol of that would actually be reading rather than collecting. What the collecting was my early engagement with science and with the sort of old-fashioned 19th century natural history versions of science, the taxonomic sciences. I loved geology from an early day. I would say, in addition to the assumption that I wanted to be a writer, which runs like a thread from at least second or third grade on, through most of my growing up years in grade school and junior high and high school, I think I would have said to you that my real passion was for science. And so geology was a great fascination, and then as the environmental movement kicked in the 1960s and 70s, increasingly biology and ecology were fascinations of mine, and again, broadly within a natural history frame of reference. So I had been engaged with, fascinated by, things scientific from late grade school on. I had a wonderful science teacher, both fifth and sixth grade, Mrs. Clark and Mr. Mutter. I remember them vividly as really fine teachers who fed my interest in science in every conceivable way. And interestingly, that became my zone of connection with Mike Zarnstorff, who went on to be the first triple major from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in physics, comp sci, and mathematics. And then would go on to be a plasma physicist when he went on to his PhD. And that was actually the circle of kids I moved in at Memorial when I sort of entered this more adult phase of adolescence, when I finally began to find really smart kids who were really interested in lots of stuff. Most of those kids were mainly interested in science. And I'll say more about that before we're done. Memorial High School was a remarkable place when I was there as a kid, and there were certain features of Memorial that are defining parts of my adult identity. But you asked about collecting, and I think that's the main message about collecting. It was the beginning of my engagement with natural history and science. I don't know whether you, as your child, you're probably not quite old enough, Western Publishing published a series of books called in the Golden Series that were edited by a guy named Howard Zim that were little field guides this big. You bought them for $1, and there were about 40 of them. on geology, on birds, on insects, on butterflies, and we must have owned 20 of those things. And I spent endless hours paging through the Zim Golden Guides to Nature, various aspects of nature. And I'm quite sure that's the beginning of the formation of me as an environmental historian. I had no way of knowing that that was what I was going to merge in my identity. But already now I've introduced you to the what I think of as the three strands that have defined my life ever since. Whenever I narrate in a one-minute narrative the passions of my youth that became my adulthood, the ones I name are this long-standing interest in writing, a long-standing interest in science and natural history as a way of understanding the world, and a long-standing interest given to me by my father in making the world make sense by connecting it to the past. Those three things are who I became.
I think we need to at least have mention here of the fourth member of the Cronin family, your brother.
My brother Bob, right.
You know, as you have these interests growing up in writing and collecting and science, one of your former students, a great friend of mine, Jim Feldman, asks it this way sometimes. How did he fit in?
I'm going to be careful about how I answer this question. I think it's fair to say that my brother Bob, who's a wonderful man and was a remarkable kid, had the misfortune to have me as his brother, which is to say, I was a hard act to follow, meaning I was kind of a star all the way through. And although my brother is super smart and more disciplined than I am, a harder, more reliable worker than I am, steadier worker, I guess might be the way I put it. He was certainly that through school. I was a hard act to follow, and I say that meaning no praise to me, quite the opposite. I would not have wanted to be my younger brother. Not because I went out of my way to make my brother's life unpleasant, and I think he accepted his lot with great grace, but inevitably, I think there was, how do I say it? His carving out his own niche was a challenge, I would say. And in many ways, he was a more normal kid than I was. And I use normal here as a term of praise. I was a pretty eccentric kid. I was a pretty weird kid. I thought a lot about strange things. I thought about nuclear war. I thought about suicide at age fourth grade, and the philosophical questions raised by suicide, and those kinds of issues, which were very scary to my parents. My brother participated in athletics. He did many more normal boy things than I did, had many more friends than I did, was much more social than I was. And was a great guy. He actually, I think, did better in school than I did, oddly. Given my high achievements tended to be eccentric high achievements. They were directed toward intense projects that I did, like this underground newspaper for 3 years, or I was hired by Madison Public Schools for 3 years during high school to produce film strips and slideshows that were used throughout the Madison Public Schools, which was one of the big activities of my high school years. So it's weird stuff like that, eccentric, kind of orthogonal stuff to what an ordinary high school kid would be doing. My brother did more normal things, but he did them extremely well. I think he was the straight-A student, not me. And he did the amazing feat. Memorial High School was then under a kind of individualized learning system called modular education in its early years, where they divided the school day into 21 20-minute units, and students could move at their own pace using the modules however they wanted to study, whatever they wanted to do, often in individualized learning ways. And I think my little brother, managed in a year and a half to go from introductory algebra through calculus, in studying on his own, going through this modular mathematics system in a way I could never have hoped to do. I never made it through calculus. My brother did it and everything else in a year and a half. So he's an amazing guy. And I would say, with that as background about the particular family dynamic challenge he faced. We had a really good set of family dynamics among the two sons and the parents. I've said that already. Through the late 60s, through the coming of the Vietnam period, through adolescence and high school. I don't remember Bob and me fighting much, and I don't think that I'm just suppressing that. We had inevitably some of the kinds of arguments that siblings have, but we were I think we had real admiration and respect for each other without spending enormous amounts of time just with each other. We were kind of in our own worlds doing our own things, but there were then these family trips and the weeks at Green Lake and all that that were points of intersection. And there were all those board games and games of hearts and bridge and all that stuff as well. So that's a quick answer. It's more complicated than that. But.
Sure. I just felt it was probably good to try to get at least, you know, your
Absolutely.
Impression of his role in the family dynamics. In one of the background pieces you gave me, you speak in detail about your interest in caving or spelunking growing up, and it seems to be something that sort of maybe bridges the sort of the prepubescent into the pubescent.
Right.
And this is published, but I still just want to get it out here and get it on the oral history. So let's start with, how did you become interested in caves?
Yeah, it is a defining part of my adolescent years, pre-adolescent through adolescent. It was probably my single most important recreational activity, and again, it's a very eccentric one, typical of me. It's actually a direct offshoot of that great circumnavigation trip in the West in fifth grade, because on the way back from that trip, we went through the Black Hills. Black Hills are the canonical jumping off place when you live in Wisconsin and are headed west. The first night stay is typically in the Black Hills. Or on the way back, it's often the last stop before you make the long drive across South Dakota and Minnesota to get back to Wisconsin. So I think it was on our return from that trip. We stopped in the Black Hills again, and the usual cave that people visit in the Black Hills is Wind Cave. It's the more famous of the caves that are there. But in whenever this trip was, which I kind of think might have been 1965, there was a national monument called Jewel Cave, Jewel Cave National Monument. And subsequently, people have figured out actually that although Jewel Cave was always thought to be the smaller of the two caves, Wind and Jewel, and Wind is the more famous, Jewel turns out to be one of the largest cave systems in the United States. It goes and goes and goes. It's a really complicated, interesting, three-dimensional matrix cave. But anyway, what was unusual about Jewel Cave then, and still unusual, is that unlike most caves that you get to tour, there were no electric lights in it, and very few developments. So that the way you toured is that a park ranger, it was a National Park Service site, would give everybody, all the adults, Coleman lanterns or flashlights, and you would tour this cave carrying your lanterns, a la a 19th century visit to a cave before they wired caves and put electricity into them. And I, of course, had never been in a cave that didn't have electricity in it, and it felt really wild. It felt really otherworldly. And remember, back to Tolkien, back to C.S. Lewis, back to Lewis Carroll and down the rabbit hole. Children's fantasy literature, particularly the journey literature of the British Inkling group, is a really defining part of my consciousness, and you may want to ask me more about that before we're done here. And one of the themes that runs through that, of course, is the underground portions of those stories. So whether we're talking about C.S. Lewis's The Silver Chair and the underground world of the evil green queen in that, or talking about Moria or Smaug's cave in The Hobbit, the underground spaces in that fictional literature are key places where crucial moments, Bilbo's acquisition of the ring from Gollum, or the assault on Smaug's treasure. Those events are underground events, and they had great kind of emotional and narrative resonance for me as a child. I'm actually less fascinated by caves today than I was in those long ago times. But I think I was pre-primed by that fantasy literature to think that the underground world was a secret world, a world accessible. Here's an ordinary landscape. Seems to be the most ordinary person in the world, and yet you go down this hole and suddenly There's this secret world that nobody knew about that is just completely otherworldly. And I think I love that. I think I love that idea. And Jewel Cave was just my first encounter with what a cave that was, what it would be like to go into a cave where you didn't have a guide, even though, of course, we did have a guide in that case. Now, the key event, though, was when we came out of Jewel Cave, we went to the museum store at the National Monument, and there was a little black and white covered book from Collier Macmillan. I remember every detail of this book, by Franklin Folsom, oddly a Rhodes Scholar, I would subsequently learn, who wrote many, many books, popular science books during that period, called Exploring American Caves. That was the book. And it was a general book on sort of all aspects of caves, their geology, their exploration, the sport of caving, the role of caves in American history. All this stuff was in this little book, which I consumed voraciously, as I typically consume books in those days. And at the back of the book was an appendix that listed all the caving organizations in the United States. And I inevitably looked under Wisconsin, and there was the Wisconsin Speleological Society. And it gave the name of a contact, a guy named Mike Wopat, W-O-P-A-T, who was, it turns out, I subsequently learned, a farm boy from outside of Lodi, Wisconsin, who, oddly, is the older brother of Tom Wopat, who would go on to be one of the Dukes of Hazzard in the famous television program. Turned out that Mike Wopat had a job as an academic staff member managing the chemistry lab in the chemistry department at UW. And so I called him up out of the blue, and here's this little fifth grade kid with his high squeaky voice saying that he's read this book on exploring American caves and he's interested in caving, and could he come to a meeting of the Wisconsin Speleological Society? And to his enormous credit, Mike Wopat didn't blow me off. He had a long conversation with me and talked about the field trips that they ran to the Hoofers at Memorial Union, which was my first encounter with Hoofers. And he invited, said I'd be welcome to come to a meeting if I wanted, and I'd be welcome to come on a field trip if I wanted. So I can't remember which I did first, going to a meeting or going on one of their field trips. The first meeting I went to was at the Wisconsin Center, now called the Pyle Center, where I remember walking into this room, and I still remember it's tall. All these people looked like very old people. They were, of course, 19-year-old college students and 20-year-old graduate students, but to me they were super grown-ups. And I still remember one of them, Jim Gilbertson, who was had a rather stark sense of humor. As I walked into the room, he looked at me and said, "I can't believe it! I can't believe it! I can't believe it!" I had the sense there were some people who were dubious that a fifth grader should be coming to these meetings, but there were several of them who were extraordinarily welcoming, and one was Mike Wopat. And so he invited me to a Hoofers field trip to visit two caves, Pop's Cave, which is in southwestern, they're all in southwestern Wisconsin, and I think the second one was Castle Rock Cave. And curiously, it was a trip that a Daily Cardinal reporter went along on as well. And she wrote a story about, a very funny story about this visit to these two caves, and I appear as one of the characters in the story. And it was a wonderful day, even though I was terrified. An oddity of my passion for caves is that I had claustrophobia. And I was always terrified, same like my fear of nuclear war, that the ceiling of the cave was going to collapse on me. And so I was always in mild terror while I was doing this, but I still loved the experience, and so I did it endlessly. And so I started becoming a regular attender of these WSS meetings. And I eventually became hooked up with a guy named Norm Frater, who was an engineering undergraduate, and again, to me he was a grown-up, but he must have been a 20-year-old kid in civil engineering. And Norm, these are all college students, but one of the activities of the Wisconsin Speleological Society was the Wisconsin Cave Survey, as it was called. And the job of the Wisconsin Cave Survey, which was supported by the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Society, which is a UW Extension entity, the Wisconsin State Geologist, who was then named George Hansen, ran WGS and supported the Wisconsin Speleological Society. And WSS maintained files of all the caves in the state at the Geological Survey. And Norm, for a year or two, was the head of the Wisconsin Cave Survey, and I became kind of his sidekick whenever he needed somebody to go with him, because you're never supposed to go caving alone. And I actually think one of the virtues from the point of view of these college students was I was this kid who was almost always willing to go off caving. And so when they needed somebody to spot them, they could count on me. They'd call me up and I'd go along. And so Norm would call me up and we would go off to visit these caves that Norm, as the head of the Wisconsin Cave Survey, was cataloging and mapping. And I actually learned surveying as an eighth grader by accompanying these engineering students who were using compasses and running tape measures through these caves to try to sketch out what the cave looked like. So I learned a lot about graphic art and mapping techniques and all that, which would be important in my later life as well, from that. And I would say this was an activity that probably occupied, I would say I was out caving 12 to 15 times a year. From, it sort of ramped up over time, but I would say from seventh grade through maybe ninth grade, it was my main outdoor recreational activity, and it remained an important activity for me through college, though it began to decline as I became more involved in high school stuff. There are two other components of caving that are important to my later identity. For a long time, I thought I was going to be a geologist, and certainly my geology is soft rock geology, meaning I'm really good at sedimentary landscapes. I know how to read karst, I know how to read landforms in a sedimentary landscape really well. So I learned basic geomorphology and basic sedimentary geology from my caving years. And so part of my passion for reading landscapes, which is a defining part of my consciousness and identity, began with this effort to find caves. And one of the odd things about caves is that once you know their geology, once you know the landscapes of karst and how karst works, karst spelled K-A-R-S-T, you can tell by looking at the landscape where there might be caves. You can see the places where cavern roofs may have collapsed, where there are indentations in the surface of the earth, where farmers have been dumping trash for decades, and so there are trees sticking up out of the middle of a farm cornfield and junk nestled among those trees. Very often those are collapsed cave roofs, and if you're lucky, they breathe hot air during the winter, and you can see clouds of steam coming out of the hole, and there's a cave there. So, and there are a bunch of things like that. When you're a caver, you study every road cut, every new quarry. You're just looking for places where caves may intersect the surface in ways that nobody has seen before. So I learned to read the landscape in that way. The other thing I did, which is now the intersection of my father's historical research world with my geological natural history world, was that I spent endless hours, dozens and dozens and dozens of hours as a junior high student, trying to find caves by looking for them in the stacks of the Wisconsin Historical Society. So what I would do is go to the Wisconsin Historical Society, sit down at a desk in the stacks for 8 hours at a time, I would say, and read the old county histories of Wisconsin that were published by Chicago publishing houses in the 1880s, and other old books, old magazines, old stuff, documents, looking for early accounts of caves. And there were a fair number of them floating around back there. And this is sort of my contribution to the Wisconsin Cave Survey. Even though I was only a kid, I was my father's son, so I kind of already knew how to do historical research, and I learned a ton by doing this archival work at the Wisconsin Historical Society. It was my first sustained encounter with an archive and with a really first-class historical research library. It's one of the reasons I'm so fond of the Wisconsin Historical Society and why I'm on its board. I'm much engaged with thinking about the mission of the Wisconsin Historical Society. That's me partly paying back the long ago debt of, it's the place where I learned how to do history at an age way prior to most people learning where history comes from and how you research documents and how you find artifacts and fragments of the past by just rummaging, by looking for a needle in a haystack, which is a lot of what history, doing history really is. So oddly, I learned historical research from caving. I learned landscape reading from caving. I found a group of friends through caving, meaning these college students actually treated me as a peer, weirdly. This smart little kid who was sort of old beyond his years intellectually, but emotionally retrograde in some ways. They took me seriously. And I felt respected. I felt like we had a common project and mission. I looked up to them endlessly. I really admired them. I was grateful for their willingness to take me along on these expeditions. In high school, my first published, serious published piece of scholarship, science actually, was an entire issue of the Wisconsin Speleologist, which was the quarterly magazine put out by WSS, cataloging all the caves of Wisconsin. And I won a prize actually from the Junior Academy, the Wisconsin Junior Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, in a science competition, won the state prize or an honorary mention or something, I don't remember what it was, for this, it's still the standard survey of sandstone caves, which are not much. Sandstone caves are not a very impressive category of caves. Of the state of Wisconsin. And that was sort of, I thought, in a way, the final product of my caving years. And I guess the one last thing I'll say about caving, I was scared caving. I'd never got over the fear of the joke, from the gallows humor among cavers is being buried deeper, cheaper. I never got over that. And I was especially afraid of heights, meaning the places in caves where you have to do vertical rope work or ladder work. I was terrified of that stuff. In fact, there's a story I should tell you about my father teaching me to rappel. Asked me to come back to that if I forget it. It's a really important statement about my father, and maybe it's the way to end the story I'm about to tell you. A curious thing about this story that I've just told you is how on earth would parents let their sixth grade son do this? Not only going out caving, which feels like a dangerous activity in and of itself, but to do it with a bunch of college students? That's unusual that parents would be willing to do that. And I think, left to her own devices, my mother in a million years would never have let me do that. She was terrified of it and felt extremely anxious, I think, although they didn't show me this very much. I mean, I don't think I then was as conscious as I now think I am of how much my mother was probably afraid of what I was doing. But my father, God bless him, I think because he'd been an Eagle Scout, because I think he knew that I was this cloistered, intense, eccentric, lonely kid, saw this as me creating a space where I was putting myself at risk, being social, doing grown-up things, and doing adventures. I was doing adventures, I guess. And I think my father said to my mother, "We have to let him do this. This is really important. And although it's a little scary, he's going to be okay. We should let him do this." My father was the risk taker. Unquestionably, he was the risk taker in their marriage. And he was willing to let his son, I think because he trusted and respected his son. And he knew that I was a careful, thoughtful, fearful kid who was not likely to... I was not the risk taker. I was a risk taker in some ways, but I'm very reluctant to do to dangerous things. So. I think he knew that about me. So yeah, unquestionably, I owe that entire swath of my life to my father's unbelievably generous willingness to let a very young boy do some seemingly very grown-up and rather dangerous things, because he understood, and this is the deep lesson from my dad that I've tried to remember in my own parenting, that the job of a parent is this long, endless process of letting go. It's this long, endless process of letting your children make choices, consequential choices, and not fake choices, but choices where they have to pay the consequences of the choices that they're making. You have to gauge their ability to handle those choices and their risk, and you constantly, obviously, have to be putting safety nets under them. But I think my father understood and believed more than most parents that I, at least, was a kid who needed to be making choices about my life. And that particularly in this outdoor risk-taking adventuring territory, that I think he understood that it was a space that I would grow up a lot if I was permitted to do it. And that unquestionably was right. I mean, caving was a big part of my passage into adulthood, if the move into middle adolescence is part of that move to adulthood. The one other example of the quality of my father's that I've just shared with you, that again I'm forever grateful for, is another very odd thing and dangerous thing that I did. It's hard to imagine in these days of fears of crazy people attacking children and the fears we now have about child molestation and all that. You would think those would be kicked into gear in the territory of the caving stories I just told. But the other thing, and I can't remember what, and a defining part of my parents' early marriage was that my father won a Fulbright to spend a year at University of Manchester in Northern England the year they were married. And frankly, it's the only reason they got married, I think. My father had asked my mother to marry him, I think, 5 times. My mother had great trouble deciding to get married. She had turned down another man who had courted her for an extended period. And she really, really had trouble making up her mind because it just seemed like too big a decision. And decisions are a problem for her. So my father had asked her 4 times. She turned him down 4 times. And then he won the Fulbright and he said, look, we need to get married. You need to come to England with me on this Fulbright, so we'd better elope. So they got married on this by eloping, so that my mom didn't have to make all the decisions involved in the wedding. The reason why it's relevant to the story I'm shaggy dogging around to get to is that one of the key things they did during that year in England was that they spent an entire summer bicycling around Europe. And I told endless stories to Bob and me growing up about this year, the summer, of biking through France and Germany and living on the open road, spending the night in either bed and breakfast or sleeping out or whatever. And I'm quite sure that their stories about that European bicycling trip became for me, notice that's part of this family travel thing, but so much a part of my father's contribution to the family culture. So one of the places other than the West, excuse me, that became important to our family's traveling was, I think when I was maybe in sixth or seventh grade, we did a circumnavigation of Lake Superior on one of these family car trips. We drove a car around and car camped around Lake Superior. And Lake Superior from that trip on became one of my sacred places on the planet, one of the really extraordinary landscapes I know in North America. And we did that trip as a family, I think a couple times, camping out as we drove around. And so when I was in high school, I conceived of the idea of bicycling around Lake Superior. And my other best friend in high school, a guy named Scott Hancock, and I decided when we were juniors in high school that we were going to spend the summer between our junior and our senior year doing the 2,000-mile bicycle trip around Lake Superior. And we announced that we wanted to do this. Most sane parents, I think, would have had great pause. But again, my father leapt into the fray, and I think probably prevented my mother from saying no, and saying, no, this is something we should let them do. So for 2 months, or 6, 7 weeks, in my summer of my junior year of high school, Scott Hancock and I bicycled around Lake Superior on one of the great defining trips of my life. Okay, it's certainly the top 5 trips I've ever taken. I kept a journal, extremely detailed journal, most detailed, intense journal keeping exercise. It filled 3 volumes of narrative of this, everything that happened along this bicycle trip. And again, I share that here just because it's another example of things in my life that wouldn't be in my life if my father hadn't been willing to let a child take risks beyond what most parents would be willing to let them risk.
Now, did you also say that there was a rappel?
Oh, yeah. The one thing that cavers need to do is occasionally, and there are not many of these in Wisconsin, but they're in places like Kentucky or Alabama or Carlsbad in New Mexico. There are places in caves where the caves become vertical, and the only way you can move through the cave is to use ropes to ascend, descend, and ascend in the caves. And that kind of vertical caving essentially is where mountaineering and rock climbing intersect with underground exploration. It's not common in Wisconsin. Most Wisconsin caves, vast majority, are not vertical. But it is a caving skill to be able to go up and down a cable ladder and to rappel and to prusik up the rope in order to be able to navigate vertical caves. And I desperately wanted as a kid, as I was gaining my caving skills, to do this. But I was terrified of heights. I was really, really scared of heights. Even more afraid, I think, than I was of claustrophobic of things collapsing on me in these caves. It's weird, I was doing these things that really scared me. And so Norm Frater one weekend, took me out to teach me how to rappel, which is where you, in the way we were doing it then, you would put a rappelling spool, which is a thing that the engineering students actually welded together themselves with a sprocket, and you would run a rope around a drum and then run the rope behind you. And by changing the tension on the rope, you could control the rate at which you slid down the rope. And that sliding down the rope is what rappelling is. And so Norm took me up to a place called Gibraltar Rock, which is still a county park in Columbia County, just north of us, near Lodi, near Lake Wisconsin. beautiful sandstone massif with a 110-foot vertical drop down the sandstone cliff, where you can tie into a tree up above and then rappel down a fairly free-falling rappel down the sandstone cliff. So Norm got the setup. It was just the two of us, and he then strapped himself in, showed me how he tied himself in, showed me how he could step out off the cliff surface, stand there, and then release the tension a little bit, move a little bit down, and showed me how it all worked. Of course, I was an endless consumer of technical knowledge. I'd read how to do this. I knew every detail. I knew how to set it up. I knew everything there was to know about. What I didn't have was the courage and the emotional control to be able to harness, leash my terror of this. So Norm rappelled down, came back up, said, "Now you do it." And I roped myself in, I set myself up, I stood there, I sat there, and I couldn't do it. I sat there for an hour, I think, and I couldn't. And he very generously, very kindly talked me through it, tried to ease my anxieties, tried to persuade me that it was okay. I desperately wanted to do it. I was terrified. I finally said, I'm never going to be able to do this. I'm sorry I wasted your time. I feel really badly, but I'm never going to be able to do this. So we put the rope away, and I literally cried the entire trip back to Madison. I just wept all the way back to Madison because I felt like I'd completely failed. I was a complete coward. It was a really important event. I mean, it was, I felt really bad about myself in a pretty deep way from that. And my father saw how upset I was, and again, this is part of so many ways in which my father is the, what's the way to put it? And my father really showed me manhood in the best sense of that word, meaning the risk-taking stuff I've been describing to you, the willingness to take risks and be courageous in the face of risk is one of the attributes of masculinity, which however one thinks about the gendering and the gender politics of it, is an admirable attribute, I would say, of male self-identity. And my father very much was the person who showed me some of that stuff. So anyway, my father saw how upset I was. And so we borrowed Norm's rope, and we borrowed Norm's spool, his rappelling spool, and drove back up to Gibraltar Rock the next weekend.
Do you need to get that?
So again, I knew everything. I don't know that my father had actually ever rappelled. I kind of think he had, but I don't remember. But I was the one who roped the tree. I was the one who did all the setup. I knew exactly what it was. I got it all set up. I roped myself in. I sat down onto the edge of the cliff. I wasn't even willing to put my legs over the cliff, I don't think. And I sat there and I sat there and I said, "Dad, I can't do this." He said, "Well, let me show you." So I unroped myself. I think I stayed on the rope. He actually literally held onto the rope and the notch we were rappelling was a little right-angled slot in the rock, and I was sitting on the ledge, and there was another ledge here, and he literally stepped out across this 110-foot chasm with only holding onto the rope just to show me that it was okay. And I was terrified of him doing that. I said, "Dad, get back here, get back there, it's not safe." And so he stepped back, and I said, "Dad, I'm sorry, I've wasted your time. I'm really never going to be able to do this." And he did one of the most amazing things, and it may sound like a horrible thing to do, it was precisely the right thing to do. He very gently picked me up under the arms and dropped me over the edge of the cliff. And remember, I was on taut rope, so it wasn't like I fell. I was hanging there. He knew that I was hanging there. So he literally just eased me over the edge of the cliff. And I was suspended in midair over this 110-foot drop. And I then released the tension, and I rappelled down the rope. And I don't think I have had very many moments in my life that were more delighted than that moment. I promptly ran back up around, and I must have rappelled down that rope 7 more times in the course of that day. I could not be prouder of myself. And it was a rite of passage. And if my father hadn't dropped me off that cliff, I still don't think I would, to this day, have ever rappelled. So again, it's another symptom of this willingness of my father to do certain things that a lot of parents wouldn't have been willing to do.
Well, we're at 90 minutes, and there are some things I need to, I think, do and try to get out of here within our sort of 2-hour time frame.
Okay.
But I do like to always leave the narrator with the last word, meaning is there anything, now that we've spoken for 90 minutes, that you feel important to get out on this recording and not have to worry about possibly losing it.
Well, so is what you're saying that you want to bring this to a halt now and pick up in a subsequent chapter? There's actually a bunch of stuff related to high school.
Yeah, and I'd
college,
like to.
And I think we should just pick up and do that. We haven't talked about Vietnam at all.
Right. And
And
I'd like to. And I'd like to pretty much next time start with that, with, you know, Memorial High School, the underground newspaper, Vietnam, and then sort of segue our way to University of Wisconsin.
Right.
Your first time at University.
Right. I think that actually forms. I think we've come to quite a good chapter point because. The caving stuff really is my junior high identity and experience through early high school. It forms, as I've narrated, a kind of passage to adulthood in its own way. And high school and college flow toward each other in ways that will, I think, form a useful unit. So that makes sense to me.
All right. So unless you have anything to add about these early years, I think this is a good place to end.
Fine by me.
All right. Thank you very much for your time today.
Okay.